to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Welcome, welcome this Monday to the Berkman Center, to the Law Lab Speaker Series. I'm John Palfrey from the Berkman Center, and on behalf of all of us here at the Harvard Law School and Harvard University, thank you for joining us for lunch. We've got Professor Joel Rydenburg here from Fordham, whom I look forward to introducing in a moment. In typical Berkman fashion, I wanted just to go around and introduce ourselves to Professor Rydenburg, and then I'll do an intro. Just a reminder to all of you in the room that this is being webcast now in real time, but also archive for perpetuity, so we hope you will speak up, but just know that you are being recorded when you do so. So maybe we will start over here and just come around.
Alan Friedman, postdoc, computer science department.
Amar Asher, Berkman staff.
Caroline Nolan, Berkman staff.
Dan Jones, Berkman staff.
Bruce Etling, also Berkman staff.
John Clipper, Law Lab.
Nick Seerick, Graduate School of Education.
Tyler Moore, Computer Science Department.
Fish Fishman, Oddfellow Studios.
Chavanira at Oddfellow Studios.
Sandra Cortesi, Fellow here at the Berkman Center.
Harry Lewis, I teach Computer Science here at Harvard.
Miriam Micka, Fellow here at the Berkman Center.
David Abrams, I'm a Berkman Fellow.
David Ardia, I'm a Berkman Fellow.
Rob Farris, I'm the Research Director here.
Kevin Bracey, Berkman staff.
I'm Ethan Catch. I'm at the University of Massachusetts.
Deb Freeman, Central Administration.
I'm Ron Newman. I'm a software developer.
And I'm Mindy Quanis, formerly at Harvard University Press and now teaching at Emerson College.
Welcome, welcome. So this is a wonderful crew assembled here to hear our special guest. I think all of you know Professor Rydenburg, but just by way of introduction. Sorry, a lunch emergency in the middle of it. So Joel is well known to everybody who practices anything remotely related to cyber law or intellectual property in this area. He actually wrote some of the very first pieces that are possibly called cyber law scholarship. The most famous, I think, early of those pieces from 1997 is called Lex Informatica, making the case that code is law, something you've heard over and over again various ways. He tells me something that I didn't know, I learned today, that in 1993 he actually has a Jolt piece, Harvard Journal on Law and Technology, in which he makes that argument before he makes it in Lex Informatica, so I'm going to go back and read that. I've read virtually everything after that 97 point of Joel's up till today, and one thing a careful reader of Joel's quite impressive scholarship will note is that he's written a series of articles that touch on XYZ and the rule of law. He's got some that deal with it on a series of the traditional cyber law topics, but he hasn't up until this point had something on privacy and the rule of law. So this is, in a way, completing a cycle of articles that he's been working on in this area. What he's talking about today is transparent citizens and the rule of law. He let me in on the secret that it might someday turn into a complete book, which would be very exciting, but sounds like it will start first with a law review article. In traditional Berkman fashion, he's going to go for about 20 minutes or so and then let us have at him. It's at an early stage. We're extremely grateful that he's willing to present at a workshop at here, and my guess is that there will be a draft, and he might even be willing to share with some of us the draft after we've had a chance at taking on the initial arguments. And I'm just thrilled that Joel's agreed to come and present here in this series. I wanted also to acknowledge my friend John Clippinger, director of the Law Lab, to the extent that you wanted to say anything further by way of intro.
I was not expecting to be here because I had another commitment.
It's our lucky day.
My lucky day. And I'm very much looking forward to it. Joel and I have sparred around some of these issues, but I think I'm very intrigued by the approach that he's taking. And maybe so some light has come.
Are you gonna, the first response is going to be Dr. Yeah. All right, Professor Rydenburg, you're on.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity to come and workshop these ideas, and I'm really looking forward to the discussion. And again, John, thank the Johns. Thank you. Let me elaborate just for a moment about this piece and where it fits in. As John just said, this is part of a series I've been working on, looking at how the networked world is challenging rule of law in many ways. And this particular paper is focusing on the privacy side and the transparency of personal information and what I think are its consequences for adherence to the rule of law. So by way of introduction, the basic argument is that we have an over-transparency of personal information giving us a transparent citizen, that as a result of that, this transparency challenges the state's faithfulness to the rule of law, it challenges private respect for the rule of law, and it challenges, the transparency gives a challenge to, in essence, the very existence of the rule of law through some systemic problems. And I'll conclude with the area I'm really keen on the discussion for and how we go about reinstantiating rule of law in the network ecosystem. So in terms of kind of introduction, this piece has grown out of some thinking about the role of the public and private distinction in democracy. We think in our democracy that privacy and having a private space and having degrees of anonymity are really critical to a functioning democracy. The notion that an individual has an autonomy in society exists through the way the society defines some of the privacy rules or privacy relationships for those individuals. In the network ecosystem, we begin to merge the public and private selves. The distinction breaks down. We have, and I'll talk about this in a moment, a real information surveillance complex that I think poses this very profound challenge to the rule of law from multiple directions. And I should just say a word. When I speak of rule of law, I'm speaking very generally, kind of at a meta level. I'm thinking of it in terms of boundaries that are established by law and that are applicable to both state and citizens alike. So the starting point is the transparent personal information that gives us a transparent citizen. We have in the network ecosystem a necessity for lots of tracking. So if we think of things like network functionality, cloud computing, mobile computing, it can't work unless we have lots of data streams and tracking of individual users taking place. We have public records, another aspect of it. Public records. With the rise of government benefit programs, those programs necessitate the collection of lots of information about individuals, the availability to government. Some of that information becomes public. So, for example, simple things. You have a driver's license, right? The license to drive. That information on your driver's license becomes public, at least in the United States. Home records, property records, mortgage records. Certain types of debts. So if you finance your car, that debt financing is a matter of public record. So you have government, the role of government as it has expanded has necessitated lots of collection of information about individuals. Our notions of open government and transparency of government, things like Freedom of Information Act, the state equivalents, means that this information is now publicly available. We see great commercial pressure toward collecting more and more personal information. So you have behavioral marketing. My favorite is a venture between a company called Alien Technology, it's a real company, and Calvin Klein. They're embedding RFID chips in Calvin Klein clothing. So pretty soon you really know where those Calvins are going through RFID tracking. But the whole notion is it's inventory tracking on the one hand, but the flip side of it is it really dramatically increases and shows that commercial pressures are pushing toward ever more localized geolocation tracking. Public safety and security imperatives drive huge collections and dissemination of information about individuals. So I like to shock my students in my privacy class. I ask them when they walk from the subway, it's a two-block walk from the subway to Fordham Law School, how many surveillance cameras they're filmed on in just that two blocks. I think we're up to about 11, the ones that we know about. Post 9/11, lots of data collection programs are out there. We now have digital strip searches at the airport. So we have public safety security pushes transparency of citizens. There's a great website called Hollaback NYC at Blogspot. It's for people who, if they think someone is harassing them on the subway, use the iPhone, film them, post the video online. So now we have private surveillance is now going public. Social networks, you know, the Facebook phenomenon, the Oprah phenomenon, gets lots of information out there about individuals. Well, in many respects, some pieces of this information has historically been transparent in a technical sense. So, for instance, public records, mortgage records, used to always be transparent. But it, as a practical matter, it was obscure because you had to go to the courthouse and find it. Now, in the cloud, online, it's a click away. It's cheap to access it. We've lost the practical obscurity. Search enables much of this information that was all, that for all intents and purposes was private, is no more. Re-identification becomes easy with data mining techniques. So information that may have been out there for some purposes but really could be disassociated with an individual, no longer. The upshot is we now have a very transparent citizen in our society. So how does this challenge the state's faithfulness to the rule of law? Well, traditionally in democracies, we have rule of law limitations on the state's intrusion into privacy. We have Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, First Amendment. In fact, some people have written extraordinary articles on the right to read anonymously. Julie Cohen walking in the room. So we have lots of important limitations on state privacy intrusions. Now, because of all of this transparent information out there, the state, in essence, has access to full dossiers, to tracking, in ways that they never had before. Jack Balkins referred to it as the national surveillance state that we're creating. If we look at how the sources of information from the private sector are now used by the government, by the state, they're doing it in a way that our society never would have tolerated the government to do in the first instance. So, example, the TIA program, Total Information Awareness Program, rebaptized the Terrorist Information Awareness Program. The sources of data for that program were largely purchased data from the private sector. So it's commercial data. It goes to the commercial data marketplace to find data. We look at ISP log files and the access that the state, that the government has obtained to ISP log files in cooperation agreements without going through a warrant process. So in the past, for the state to really be able to engage in detailed citizen surveillance, the state would have needed warrants based on probable cause, or would have needed to deploy extraordinary financial resources to hire lots of policemen to follow people around all the time, right? Which is a society we would not have been likely to accept. Now, we don't need it because the data is out there. In essence, if you think about the state combing the web and using search and looking on the web, you can wiretap the web through search without having a warrant, right? Because a lot of the data to figure out individual X, Y, or Z likes to do A, B, and C on Mondays and Tuesdays from these hours, and they go to these restaurants. It's readily out there. Some of you may be aware of a public event involving my class and a file on a justice of the Supreme Court. Right? All of this information was out there in the public. Just now, in amassing it together, begins to take on a very different type of character. We think of fusion centers. Fusion centers are centers established in cooperation between state and local law enforcement and the federal government. Their purpose is essentially to engage in surveillance of the citizenry without suspicion-based. I mean, as we usually think, a government engages in surveillance of an individual because the person is a suspect. There's some suspicion that generates, that triggers the surveillance target. The fusion centers invert it. Fusion centers say, let's look at patterns of behavior to figure out who our suspects are. And again, much of the data comes from private sector sources to be able to track patterns. In essence, what we now see is a non-transparent government, because so many of these programs are happening off a political radar screen, getting data from private sector sources, compiling large, I'll call them surveillance-type databases, with a loss of the legal constraints that we historically impose on government when it wants to engage in surveillance of citizens. So that's where we begin to see the government can move away from having a faithfulness to principles of rule of law, constraints on engaging in broad, overarching surveillance of its public. Well, what's the private reaction to this? And here's why I say we have a transparency challenge to the private respect for rule of law. One of the first things we've seen is a rise in cryptography and more robust cryptographic tools. So enhanced cryptography now enables wrongdoers to behave on the net in ways that their wrongdoing can escape detection or prosecution. We have other phenomena. Juicy Campus was a famous one for the university crowd a couple of years ago. More recently, there's a great case that's been in New York. It's the Skanks and Hoes case in New York. There is a fashion model in New York who was being disparaged, she alleged defamed, on a anonymous blog. And she wanted to bring an action and first had to figure out who the blogger was. In this instance, the anonymous blogger wasn't very clever about hiding her identity. It was on a Google Google-owned Blogspot. So Lascula Cohen, the model, sued Google under a provision in the New York Civil Procedure Law to disclose the identity of the blogger to then bring the defamation action. So it's an illustration of the phenomenon trying to hide behind anonymity to commit wrongdoing. In that case, the blogger wasn't terribly successful because she hadn't deployed very robust tools to hide her identity. But the more the public perceives surveillance on the net, I think the more robust and the more widely used anonymity tools will become and be deployed, making it much harder to track down and stop wrongdoers. And then you can think back to this Hollaback website where you post potential, you know, the harassers on the New York City subway harassers on a blog. Well, there's a fine borderline between that and vigilantism. And those sorts of postings, if they become done anonymously or encrypted, again, make it very difficult to preserve the kind of private respect for the rule of law that we've traditionally anticipated. So the last portion, the last challenge that I want to address is the transparency challenge to the existence of the rule of law. So here it comes in two ways. One is on the security side, the security threat. So I'm going to take the case of the Scalia dossier because I think it's a really good illustration. We did the exercise in my information privacy class as an exercise to see how transparent information was on the web, how secondary use is a major issue, how what regulation may or may not affect the collection of the data, the use of the data. Amassing a lot of detailed information about him was reasonably trivial exercise. It could be automated. I'm sure some of the computer scientists in the room could tell me probably would take them less than a day to write the script to do the automated search. So take that concept and think, okay, what if we do a comparable file on every flag officer in the military? And one of the things we found without a lot of effort was mother's maiden name, a lot of information about homes, past addresses, all the key elements you need to commit identity theft. So now, if you amass dossiers, it doesn't take a great leap of logic to recognize that the transparency means there is a tremendous security threat for anyone involved in critical infrastructure, because a dedicated wrongdoer could readily amass files on lots of people and launch attacks simultaneously, disrupt their family life, disrupt their social networks quite easily. So there's a security side that this over-transparency has. The second challenge to the very existence comes from our faith in the legal system. So we've seen a couple of interesting cases percolating that I think are the tip of the iceberg. Social networking and judges. Right? What happens, how do we perceive the integrity of our legal system? Well, what's the role of our judiciary? We have a case in New York where a judge in Staten Island was moved out of Staten Island because it turned out he was Facebooking, you know, Facebook friends with lots of people who were appearing before him in court. So it gives the impression to litigants of some level of unfairness in the legal system. Florida's just issued a judicial ethics opinion saying it's basically unethical for a judge to include, to friend anyone who might appear before the judge. Because by friending someone who might appear before the judge, it gives the, it violates an ethical canon that a judge can't endorse a lawyer. So if I'm the judge's friend on Facebook, it appears to members of the public I'm endorsing that lawyer if I'm the judge.
Say who yeah. might appear before the judge. Couldn't any citizen in that district possibly might appear before the judge?
That's the problem, isn't it?
And federal court judge, the whole state can appear.
Well, they're talking about this is an issue. They're thinking mostly on the law. This ethical rule dealt with lawyers appearing before the judge. But the same problem arises if it's a witness. Suppose the witness who is appearing in the court is on the lawyer's social network. And is there a difference between Facebook and LinkedIn? Do we want a system where if a judge, do we say, because of this problem for the perception of integrity in the legal system, we keep our judges unplugged? Well, that means our judges are really disconnected from the community in a very important way. So there's a very substantial challenge that this poses. We have a risk of corruption of the jury system, what I like to call Googling jurors. Right, Googling jurors comes in two flavors. It's the juror who Googles something about the case he or she is sitting on. Right, that's one problem. We have very elaborate rules of evidence to preserve the integrity of the trial that can now be bypassed. We don't let the jurors, for example, visit the crime scene. Now they go on Google Earth, they visit the crime scene virtually. But it flips around. Lawyers Googling potential jurors, finding out information outside the voir dire process about the potential jurors. So there's a whole range of problems for the integrity of the jury system itself that this transparency, online transparency, poses. So I've mapped out, and I'll draw it to a close with kind of my concluding area. I've mapped out these areas where we have the transparent citizen. It's challenging how the state is going to be faithful to principles of rule of law. It challenges how the private sector response challenges rule of law through enforceability problems, wrongdoers being able to hide from accountability. It challenges some core notions we have about public safety and security, faith in the legal system. Well, what do we do about it? Here, I think we need to begin to focus on how we can reinstantiate the rule of law in this network ecosystem where information has to flow for the network to function. So what do we do? I want to throw out, we need to begin to focus much more carefully on a norm of data misuse and a notion that there is limited purpose knowledge. That when information is generated in the network ecosystem, it's generated for some type of use. It's generated for some kind of reason. And knowledge of the information for that reason is appropriate and necessary. But knowledge for other purposes becomes the misuse. That's the norm of data misuse. You begin to think about, you know, how might this affect expectations in social networks, social network expectations. I love this story. Any of you who have sort of tweens or teen children, or no teens or tween children, know that, you know, if you're Facebook friends with your kid, you know, your kid generally doesn't want you to be Facebook friends because, well, there's some things they know, all their friends know everything about them, but they don't want the parents to know, right? There's a notion that even though this is out there, it's public, it's only public for some purposes. That's this notion of limited purpose knowledge. And if we take that concept, what would it translate into for the network and network infrastructure? Well, it translates into trying to re-engineer practical obscurity back into the network. Now, how? And what? You know, how do you get there? I knew I'd get a rise out of the computer scientists. Can you begin to look at the information that is Transparent for Purpose Acts. And the Transparency for Purpose Acts is determined in Helen Nissenbaum's terms is contextual integrity. You look at why, what the context is, that the information is transparent. And any deviation from that, any attempt to use it from other than that, is tagged in some fashion as the misuse, or tag, maybe it's a positive use tag, and anything else is wrongful use. Does that begin to help us move toward a world where we can now have a greater check on what government is doing with data that's out, that is out there? Because it now becomes feasible to identify when government is acquiring and using data outside of its limited purpose knowledge. Is that a world in which the private respect for rule of law can be reinvigorated, and where the challenges to our legal system can be ameliorated? So I'm going to close on that. I figure that probably gives lots to talk about.
I think you've provoked on many scores, which is excellent.
That's the goal.
That's fabulous. So, Bill, thank you so much. I think there will be a bunch of people with hands up. I wonder if I might start over here with Dr. Clippinger, and Julie Cohen has come in, and Urs Gasser, the PI of the Law Lab, and our executive director. Maybe I can see you three up for initial comments. Is that allowed?
Sure. Joel, I completely concur with your analysis. But I would have to depart with your remedy, not surprisingly. I mean, but I no one can say that they really have this figured out. I mean, I think that and this is where the technology becomes very important. And I think, and how to inform this, because I think a lot of the remedies are going to be dependent upon a combination of policy and technologies. And my own view is that we're in a process of experimentation where you're going to create what I would call sort of membership networks, where you have different kinds of invention of sort of private law to explore ways of doing these things. And I would suggest that there are things like zero knowledge proofs. There are lots of things that actually should be thought about as a way of providing some of these guarantees. And you're going to have different norms and different principles in different situations. But to infer intent and link it to a context, I mean, as someone, I mean, things are multi-contextual. And there'd be a myriad of disagreements over that. But I think that we're in a process of evolving new norm sets. And I do think that that has to be informed by a combination of technologies and rules and governance principles that we don't really know right now. I'd be interested in your take on that, because I think if you come in right now and make a prescription and try to have that codified in law and policy right now, it would be guaranteed to be create problems. And maybe there's a way of doing the exploration. I agree with the intent. And I think there are a number of people here who the groans were coming from that the computer science department. So it's like, okay, chirp in on. So I laud your intent, but I can't agree with the remedy at this point.
Should I?
Yeah, please, and I'll just go down the line after that.
Yeah, it's like a firing line.
I came in late. They just called on me.
That's how it works. It's a rule.
You were invoked as you walked. That's you're welcome to pile up questions.
Right.
Yeah. So, I have really conflicting responses to this, because there are a lot of points of intersection with the talk I gave in this very room last week about wanting to foster what I called semantic discontinuity, so that it would just be harder to make all of these connections so seamlessly. But I guess, so the tension for me is some of what I heard I experienced you saying, just as, you know, oh, my kids can have friends on Facebook, and I don't know, you know, everything about my children. Isn't it horrible? And so, you know, I'm hearing, you know, I'm not sure whether I'm hearing, oh, isn't this horrible? Can we just put it back the way it was before? you know, or, oh, isn't this new? Can we maybe devise some kinds of new situations for, you know, separating context from one another and introducing discontinuities that that don't necessarily involve trying to freeze every piece of data in its place. So I'm sort of not really sure where you're coming from, and I was really surprised to hear Hollaback thrown in as an example of undesirable vigilantism. That might take us down a whole different road. You know, like the example of like women and trying to empower themselves and shift the discourse becomes the one example of undesirable vigilantism that you mentioned. I'm like not sure where that's coming from. I would like to know. So those are just some of my initial reactions, but I wasn't expecting to be called on. So
that was interesting. You want to respond?
Yeah, because it actually, I think it links with what John just said too. It was the latter of your two. I mean, the Facebook example with the kids was more, it wasn't, oh, it's awful that I don't know. No, to the contrary. It was really about they perceive, the perception that it's information that they're disclosing publicly, but really only semi-publicly. That the notion that someone else other than a particular group of people would gain access to it is horrifying to them. So, I mean, I think that was really what that illustration was driving at. And I see this as being, there's something new about this, and not so much, you know, put the genie back in the bottle, as it is, how do we go forward with it? And it's important, yeah, John, I think what you're getting at. Yeah.
Disclosure. So yeah. How do you, and there's a certain expectation that goes with that, within a particular context, community, that you can make explicit and through a technology or a policy of some form. You can embed that, embody that, and you may give users recourse and by which they can affect that over time. But that's different than having an imposition of a statute or trying to have
it. But isn't it saying the default?
What?
It's, I think what I'm really saying is the default is that the disclosure is selective ab initio. That I think what we see happening with the transparency, I mean, look at Scalia's reaction. You know, he professed to be shocked and appalled. But the stuff that's out there, you know, none of this, I mean, these were from news stories. I mean, it's out there. It was out there in context A, not put together in context B.
But you were not going to have a credit bureau business if you do that. I mean, the Equifaxes and the Axioms and the Xfinity, that's exactly what they do.
But they started using information that was
it's a different. Well, they gather that information on one context and use it for another.
But hold on. There, I guess I would disagree, because in the context of an axiom for its consumer reporting activity, forget its marketing side, its consumer reporting activity, from what an axiom does or what a TransUnion or an Equifax does, is done, as you were pointing out, that's done through a whole network of contracts, including that. The contracts with the account holder. I'm an account holder. My account information in my contract with my credit card company, it's explicit that that's going to be going to consumer reporting bureaus.
That's not that point.
I mean, that's part of the context of use.
No. I mean, if you have these knowledge-based authentication methods that, you know, you'll call and they'll say, well, okay, which of these things are true? They're collecting information on where I was resident, what I paid, what I did in order to authenticate me to get an access to a particular service. That was information that was generated for one purpose being used for another purpose to create access privileges.
Plenty of other people do authentication without assembling a dossier in your entire life.
Right.
All right, I want to get some other voices in. Professor Dr. Gasser, would you?
So I have two questions, actually. The first question is, with this idea of focusing on purpose and context and introducing some sort of a tagging system, don't you create another layer of transparency, which then leads to a transparency problem, actually, that you described in the last part? And the second question is, isn't the problem of context transfers of information today a slightly different one than the one you described? Because it seems to me the one that you described focused very much on certain units of meaning or information that comes very much from our traditional world of media. So for all the examples you gave, basically like friends on Facebook and so forth, is kind of a chunk of information that is a meaningful unit. But I'm much more concerned actually about the communication process leading to this particular unit of knowledge or chunk of information, which actually has a lot to do with meta information as we go along, right? So if you post something on Facebook, it's not only what you see in Facebook, but actually the information that is collected. When do I connect with my iPhone, type in the message, and so forth. So the granularity of information has changed. It's much finer granularity in the digital ecosystem. And there, I think it becomes very tricky to operate with context as a criterion, because meta information and fine-grained information is increasingly without context. And that's the particularly dangerous thing, that meta information is reconfigured in totally different contexts, but you can't tell anymore whether this particular small piece of information actually had a context or not.
That's a really good question. I mean, I don't mean in any way to exclude the transactional data and the data. What you're really talking about is data mining and what you can learn from data mining and data mining metadata in taking it from however it was generated into making inferences about individuals on the basis of that. And you know, there will always be justifications for the utility of engaging in a data mining practice, or you know, you're going to get a service if you do X, Y, or Z. And isn't that service wonderful? I guess what I'm trying to hone in on is there's a big downside and cost to that. So taking the metadata, to the extent that it is without context, then in essence almost any use of it, if it's not in a truly anonymized form, which is going to be very hard to accomplish, any use of it now begins to morph away from the concept I'm throwing out is this limited purpose knowledge. Now, is the adverse consequence of a regime like I'm describing worse than loss of rule of law? I think that's really what it's kind of, your argument is the adverse consequence is worse.
I don't think that's your option, but you're framing it that way. But I don't think it's your option. I mean, I think there are other options.
Can I just ask how you're defining rule of law for purposes of, it's been used a lot.
So. Yeah, I started out saying it's just very basic, that you have a boundary that's established by law that's applying to the state and its citizens. So you have some kind of legal regime, legal law, statute, law, constitutional doctrine that is applicable to the both the state and the citizens are respecting.
That you have a set of contracts that are voluntary entered within a context, and that those, in a sense, become the way in which you can innovate as a respect to how you're going to enforce or recognize a different set of conventions, and be binding it throughout some kind of external statutory law.
That works provided that the private law regime does not have an externality undermining your public law. So the example, I mean, I'll give, and that's, so take the case, for example, you know, we have a private law regime that is in place. There are contracts between ISPs, phone companies, and their customers about the use of their data. Those contracts, in turn, in many instances, will allow the phone companies to volunteer data to the government. So you have a systemic issue. I mean, we saw that systemically with a series of phone companies after 2005, 2004. At that point, I think you have a tension between the public and your private network of contract.
I think that's a different issue, but I don't.
With respect, I'm going to go a few other people and maybe come back. You actually didn't get an answer to your first question, did you?
It's great.
Yes?
Okay. I wanted to go back to the statement you made that you thought that there should be sort of these artificial boundaries imposed into the data collection and retrieval system. So I'm trying to understand, it seems like it's almost, you're adding in a presumption of guilt to the person who's trying to retrieve the data. I mean, there's all kinds of reasons I might be wandering around real estate records, which are public, and should I have to say why I'm looking at the real estate records? I mean, I could be writing a novel, I could be looking for a long-lost friend, I could be reporting news, I could be interested in finding out what, I could be doing it for business purposes because I work for a realtor company. Should I have to say why I'm looking at that data? And if three days later I decide I want to do something else with it, what would I do then?
Okay, let me come back. Let me unpack that in a couple of ways. You said something that I guess I would take issue with. You said it's an artificial restriction, and I would take issue with that because you could just as easily say it's an artificial construct that all of the data flows uninterrupted as well. I mean, that's a technical choice. How much or when or why information would be available. In terms of permissible purpose or permissible use, there's an interesting analogy. In the Drivers Privacy Protection Act, the statute defines, in essence, why the information on your driver's license is in the public domain. It sets out a series of the data. I mean, if you think about what's on your driver's license, right? Your height, your weight, your eye color, medical conditions, if it affects your driving, will show up on your driver's license. Whether you're an organ donor, in many states, shows up on your driver's license. Where your current address is on your driver's license. Well, that's the question. Okay, and your photograph. Most digital. Well, but what? No, that's. That's a public record. Okay. But again, it goes back to why. Why is that data public record? The Driver's Privacy Protection Act says, and it's a federal statute, but it applies to the states through the funding power. It basically says if states want highway funds, they have to have their state law in compliance. It limits the public disclosure of the driver's license data to a series of reasons, right? Things like car recalls. You know, it's very helpful for Toyota right now. You know, there'll be a series of reasons. And what is it doing? It's really defining the rationale and the purpose for which that data is made public. I think that is something that we ought to be doing for public records. So if you were to ask me personally, yes. Would we as a society do that? I don't know. Would it mean the property records, for example? Sure. Why is it that the property record in our society, what's the rationale for having the property record a public record? A couple of reasons. The basic rationale is we want the tax assessment record is what's part of the public record. Who owns the property? You need to know who owns it for sale and transaction purposes. What the tax assessment is, that's an equity issue within the community, and it's a way of checking that government is behaving properly. If I can review everybody's tax assessment on their property, I know that government is behaving properly. So we see those as reasons. Primary reasons why that information is made public in the first place. If there's a mortgage holder on the property, that's a critical piece of information. Now, because it's public for that, does it mean that the same data should now be available for purveyors of smelly soap to begin to profile me as, you know, someone who lives in X, Y, or Z community and I'm likely to want to buy his or her product? I think once we start moving down that path as a society, it begins, you know, that's where we wind up with this transparent citizen and greater and greater problems with how our democracy will be able to function.
Good. Shannon.
So I've been involved in data privacy for a while. I'm former executive director of the TOR project. Mm-hmm. And what I see is as a part of this that you might want to look at is if you go to the EU, they have the agency Prime, which I'm sorry, does anybody remember what it stands for? Anyway, you can find it if you just search for privacy and Prime in EU. But Prime defines data privacy as a consumer protection issue.
and they have an entire code of law and practice defined in the EU on what can be revealed and what can't in terms of consumer information. And, you know, one of the things that we don't have in the United States, and you talked about the ISPs and Google giving up user data, is that we don't have, you talk about transparency, you know, if you read privacy policy, it's not English, it's weaselly, it generally sits there and says we can change it at any time and we don't have to tell you, and it basically comes down to, we really kind of like to think that we do these things, but really, we'll do anything we damn well please with your data. When it comes down to it, that's what it boils down to. If there were something that were either legal or, you know, consumer mandated practice that set up a structure like Creative Commons, where people could look at a website and at the bottom it said privacy policy, you know, no resell, you know, you control this granularity of your data, we do not track you with cookies, you know, at the bottom of the thing. And we will not give up your data without a subpoena. We will give up your data without a subpoena. You know, and that's one of the biggest things is that, you know, when I was running a community network in Oregon, we had people about every couple months, law enforcement will walk in through the front door and say, we need all of the information on the Cascade Forest Education Project or Earth First Journal. And they would sit there and say, just a moment, we'll call Shava. And I would come up front and I'd say, officer, can I help you? And he would sit there and say, we need all of the mailing lists for Earth First Journal. And, you know, all the email addresses that's on their email list. And I sat there and said, that's wonderful. Do you have a subpoena? And their reaction over and over with several different people in isolation from each other was, nobody else asks us for that. So, you know, unless we have ISPs and hosts with spines, you know, or telecom companies with spines, you know, the government's always going to be able to go in and get this data. And unless we have public education to tell people why they shouldn't give away their genome for a coupon for a Big Mac, you know, people are not going to demand it. And if people don't demand it, there's no political will behind it.
Okay, do you have a question or
that's, no? Well, you know, it's just basically, you know, we should be doing what Prime's doing. We should be doing education, but I'm not sure tagging the data is even practical.
Okay. Well, you're hit, if we just, the EU side, if I could just hit on that, the EU treats data privacy as a basic human right rather than as a consumer protection matter. The directive and the European Convention, the 1981 treaty declares it's a human privacy is a human right, and that's really the direction. The court, you know, I don't know that many people follow the UN, whereas the EU is directive is certainly law throughout the European Union. There's an interesting aspect of something that you were saying about the education and the sort of the ISPs with the spine. That's really going to what's the social norm? Mm-hmm. You know, how do we perceive the social norm? And you know, it harkens back to the discussion earlier. Is it really through law dictating? Is it something else? Is it the technology? Right now, I think we're in a time period, and I would share John's sense of the fluidity of our times. We're in a time period where I think users and citizens have certain expectations about what's happening to their personal information that doesn't match what indeed and in fact is happening to that information. And there's a big disconnect now. And the answer, you know, maybe the answer is focus on education, the raising social awareness, developing a set of private contractual, private law arrangements that mesh the social expectation with the reality. You know, that's one path. I don't think that's a path that's going to ever work. You know, we've seen sort of the self-regulation model of data privacy in the United States for 30 years, and we're still talking about the same problems. It hasn't worked in the U.S. You know, the other path is trying to find some kind of interdependent law, technological push for what I call reinstantiating practical obscurity.
Without the public awareness, though, are you going to get political will to change the law?
Professor Lewis, and then Mr. Abrams.
Really interesting. Rather than go down any further down the paths, I've got all the same questions everybody else has about a lot of these things. But how is this going to apply to the private surveillance thing? This is so ordinary citizens can now collect all kinds of information. You know, I you can buy license plate reading cameras for about $250 now. It will, you know, you set them up outside your house and start to build up a database of who's going around. Gather, you know, get your little social network. You can actually, you know, get a pretty good. So, you know, what do you do about that? Where does that? Are you gonna, you know, where does the onus of responsibility fall in a way where the legal system would get its hooks into what people do about these private data collection activities?
I guess I would come back to the notion, if you're the private, engaging in private surveillance, what's your purpose for the surveillance? Is it just to be generally voyeuristic, you know, make things voyeuristic for society? That's a tough one. I'm going to bracket that for a moment while I ramble to think of an answer to that. If it's something for more specific, if it's a more specific use that you're engaging in surveillance. So the quintessential example might be a surveillance camera in a building, private property surveillance camera. Why is it there? Generally, the purpose for installing it's going to be for security. Some association with building security, letting people in and out, monitoring who's coming in and out. Do you restrict the third, fourth, and fifth type of uses for that data? I think the answer should be yes, because the individuals who are going to be captured on those surveillance cameras, what's their expectation? Their expectation is, I walk into a building, I know there's a camera there. I know there may be some security concerns. Fine, that's how it's being used. But now, if all of a sudden it's being used, you link up five different building cameras to start to follow me, and then you sell that to the local Gap store
you own the chain of shopping malls, you put them at the entrances of the shopping malls and track when people are going in and out and what other malls they're going to, and mm-hmm. you know, who's executing transactions in those stores at the, you know, at the time. There's all kinds of stuff you can do that would be, you know, commercially valuable to do.
And absolutely. And that's why I come back to, you know, what if it's for sort of the purpose behind it is for a public use, then that to me begins to sound very Orwellian. And instead of our concern primarily being the state engaging in the surveillance, we've now enabled, encouraged
we didn't do anything. You know, Moore's Law happened, right?
Right,
you know?
Exactly.
Shit happens, right? So this is where.
So the
question is, you know, does the law come in and assert a new prohibition on activity just because, you know, what I used to be able to do by snapping my 35-millimeter camera, which wouldn't really get me enough data to do anything with, you know, I can now do with extreme efficiency.
My answer to that would be, if we want to preserve, maybe we don't want to preserve anymore, our notions of this very basic sense of rule of law. We don't want the state intruding into private lives. We don't want the state knowing everything about us and our activities. If that is still an accepted starting point, then the answer to your question is yes.
But I mean, it's you know, it's me, the curious guy with the camera that mm-hmm. you're at this point getting into.
Can I try one turn for this, just to bring it back to something you said earlier?
So one of the problems that you raised along the way is the third-party data problem. So for those who don't know, basic loophole problem in U.S. law, at least, that that you have Fourth Amendment protection against collection of information directly by the state, you know, with appropriate due process and so forth. But if they go and get information from third-party providers, Harry's set up private actors, by and large, those rules don't apply. There are also other issues associated with it, but just hone in on that one. Would you change this particular Fourth Amendment or statutory loophole in response to Professor Lewis's claims?
And make it illegal for the state to acquire the information.
Yeah. Or some other usage-based prohibition, or subject it to the same, you know, warrant rules.
Yes. Or if you can't, yeah. I would. I would not. I would want to see restraint on the state gaining access to all non-state generated surveillance type information.
And we do a constitution. Even if it's
collected for the purpose of preventing crime. So I'm annoyed at litter in my street. I put up a surveillance camera. Uh-huh. I abide by this general policy. I only use it for the security thing. I turn away people who ask for it. But then someone throws a can on the street. Should the state be allowed to come, or should I be allowed to give it to the state? So I'm crossing a boundary, but I'm still in the context.
Yeah. I would probably want to protect the boundary, because the consequences of not protecting that boundary, it's such a slippery slope. There's another example, and this is sort of, I never answered Julie's question about why holla back. I actually, in the last time I gave the talk, I used a similar type of example of kind of this secondary use. It was a little bit different. It's not the cases involving a webcam on the Texas-Mexico border that was ostensibly put in place for catching, identifying illegal immigrants coming across, and it was actually the government that put these in. So it's a little bit different from the private sector one. The government puts it in, and the only success story that they point to is drug smuggling. So you have sort of an interesting case example in that the reason for the deployment, it's unsuccessful for that. It's used for general crime interdiction. There's a lot of discussion, for instance, about what we've done post 9/11, allowing the kind of searches that we do that are ostensibly for terrorism, but in fact they seem to be morphing into general crime interdiction, where everybody's a suspect.
I actually had a comment on something that was for this discussion, so I don't know how far.
I have a separate question.
All right, so it seemed like at the very end of the last discussion you had advocate a return to sort of privacy through obscurity, which is a wonderful concept, but there seems to me there's a barrier to it, which is the Supreme Court doesn't understand it. In 2002, there was a decision, I think it was Jones, that had to do with sex offender registry, bad cases making bad law. And essentially, you could always get the information by going up to Alaska and opening a police file, and therefore the Supreme Court. So there was absolutely no difference between that and putting the entire thing on the Internet. Really brilliant legal analysis. And that, but when I read that decision, it seemed like we were sunk, because that meant that there was no data that was essentially public but obscure that couldn't be put on the Internet through that case. There was just no way to argue. And in fact, you'll remember there was an incredible problem that all these divorce records had Social Security numbers and private information. And so it seems like we have a judicially created barrier to saying, well, there's certain information, even though it's public, we're not going to make it widely publicly available. And
the current court may be a little more sensitive to privacy issues these days. They actually have a couple of cases before.
That it would be interesting to see.
Published.
No, I'm saying publishing the registry in Alaska, the sex education. And I'd be curious to see if in retrospect maybe.
I'll tell you what would be interesting. It's going to be interesting. There's a case before the court now out of the Ninth Circuit dealing with names on a political petition for the Washington
referendum. And the arguments go both ways.
And it's going to be very interesting to see how the court and how the lineup is on that. But
a big fuss here in Massachusetts about, you know, somebody
created a, what was it called, Know Your Neighbor or something like that, and they were publishing the names and addresses, I think, of everybody who had signed an anti-gay referendum initiative, and it was very controversial.
Well,
a lot of people who were on
the same
political side as these people said this is going beyond what's acceptable, and others didn't, so...
Come back to sort of the case, these two points. If in like the sex offender registry on the NAT, there, and if I remember correctly, there was some interest analysis. What's the state's interest? Why is this being made public? And why is it being made public nationwide versus local community? And with geolocating of IP addresses, you know, it's not going to be perfect for everybody, but certainly with the greater geolocation that we're seeing for users on the net, the notion that we may make information available to a local community, political activism in a local community is within the local community, visible within the local community space on the net, we might in the future be able to see some kind of segmentation like that. But if you take a look at, say, a sex offender registry versus driver's license data, there'll be different public interests for why one might not want practical obscurity for data in this bucket, but still want practical obscurity for data in another bucket that's nevertheless publicly generated information, public information.
Really interesting idea. Can I have a research exemption for all this? We spoke earlier about the challenge of sharing data, and I'd just like to have, I think that, you know, academics should be allowed to get data from anywhere they can. How would you deal with research?
I would deal with research as others. It's not a free pass. One of the tricky areas, and this is what we were talking about this before, to the extent that data can truly be anonymized, then you shift away from the privacy concerns that you have. But there's been a lot of computer science research lately indicating that re-identification isn't very hard to do. Paul Ohm, who I think you may have mentioned, was here recently, has his Broken Promises paper that is really suggesting there are some challenges to the way privacy law can treat data processing because anonymity as a basis doesn't work. So again, for researchers, that's a problem. But I think it goes back, you know, might you have... contractual confidentiality requirements and ways to do analyses with confidentiality that might be helpful for some purposes. Yes, does it causes other problems for researchers? But I don't think that research should be a hunting license to violate privacy.
I'm just curious about this because it's not directly related to privacy issues, and I'm curious whether you see there's any relationship to it, but it's the question of accuracy of information. I mean, you're talking about the release of all information. My sense is that if you want to consider the development of new norms, it's likely to come out of individuals perceiving that not that the information about them is out there, but that it's inaccurate information that's out there. And the context in which I've been looking at this is in the medical records context, and we're on the eve of more widespread use of electronic medical records. In the current system, which I think is intended to be a contextual system, release of particular information to particular entities, and not the general release of information, but it's the release of information currently to a group of entities that are familiar with each other. We're about to enter into the access to electronic medical records by individuals. And individuals are going to find out what's on their records. They won't know who it's going to any more, I think, than they currently know who it's going to. But they're going to be concerned about the fact that they're going to find mistakes. And when you're collecting and processing so much information, inevitably there are mistakes.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's in part why the notion of limitations to functional, to purposeful use is so important, because in the context of the collection and the rationale for the collection, I think it is more likely that inaccurate data either gets caught or has a potential for less significant harm. Once you start morphing and moving data out of those contexts, if it is not inaccurate to start, the chance that as it moves along a chain no longer has a degree of accuracy for describing whatever it is it's being used for. So what might be an example? If information describing me for a particular transaction, right, there's a piece missing. My address is wrong. My address, instead of being 17, is 19. Right, has no impact on the particular transaction. Now that data, the erroneous address, it's off, the number's been misentered, moves down the lane, and it gets to a point where a judgment about me is being made. Now I don't know about it. It's non-transparent to me. The fact that there's a mismatch between 19 and 17 cancels whatever it was, the transaction. It flags it as identity theft. It flags it as a fraudulent transaction. That's problematic. And I think the risks and those harms are magnified in a system where there aren't checks along the way for data being passed off from one entity to another to another. So in part, the answer is the accuracy problem is magnified in a world where there aren't structural limitations on use of data for secondary, tertiary purposes.
We usually go for about an hour. I can tell that this could go on for many more hours. You've clearly hit some interesting topics and veins here. I want to offer to my colleague, Urs Gasser, do you have any last words, want to wrap up on behalf of the Center or the Law Lab at all?
Just love to say thank you, and thanks to all of you. It's a terrific presentation, a great discussion. I learned a lot. I think the concept is fascinating. The topic is fascinating. Forward to further exchanges with all of you. Thank you.
Wonderful.
Please join us. Thank you very much. Thank you.